try not to be old-fashioned, right? But I'm just not yet ready to surrender the value of human interaction.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Kyle Gunderson. Kyle is the president and CTO at Revel Health, a Minneapolis-based software company that uses advanced analytics to create health action programs. He runs a team of 20 engineers that's growing 50% year over year. He's also a tech veteran with experience running multiple high-growth teams. In this episode, we talk about how he uses data to navigate tough product roadmap conversations. We also learn how he attracts top talent without building a remote team, and how he uses a scorecard to make smarter hires. This conversation was fun for me because we talked about some things we're completely aligned on, like empirical hiring practices, and we also got to talk about things we disagree on, like remote work. This interview runs the gamut, and I'm excited to share it with you. And now, here's my conversation with Kyle Gunderson. Kyle Gunderson, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, really happy to be here.
So what got you into building software, Kyle?
Wow, that is a way back question. That is, I was just telling somebody the other day that is the result of what happens when 18-year-olds make decisions on their professional career. I landed in an applied mathematics program, so I have a mathematics background, and it turns out when you have a mathematics background, some of the jobs that are available there are in software engineering and computer science, and so I ended up with a mathematics degree and found myself in this business. And after you've lived through it long enough, they let you try to lead teams.
How did you make your transition from a builder to a leader of teams?
Well, I think it was about having the same things that made me successful as an engineer started to make me think about how to lead teams and how to be productive in building software. And those things were looking for logical approaches to solving problems. It's just a different problem set, and it was thinking about how to be improve operational efficiency. And so I think I just was naturally drawn to a different set of problems to solve. I had solved sort of software engineering and architectural problems, and I became, I think, intrigued by solving these people problems and these organizational problems and the challenge, which seemed really interesting to me, the challenge of marshaling a group of really smart people around the goal of creating solutions that would help people.
Distributed systems are fun. Human distributed systems are fun and maybe even a little harder.
Yeah.
We talked earlier about how, as an industry, we're moving towards more agile, responsive processes, but often the business is not. They're more quarterly basis, monthly basis. How have you been able to square those two things?
Yeah, that's a really interesting challenge. And I've been in a number of different businesses, and that challenge, I don't think I bring it to every business. I just think it lives in our industry. And businesses get themselves in a cadence, and understandably so, where they want predictability, right? They want predictability on these natural cadences. Most businesses work on those 90-day cadence. And so they get comfort from the idea that they can look out 90 days and say with certainty, this is what's going to happen. But the reality of it is that's not really what they ask for in the day-to-day. What the businesses really ask for from software engineering teams is to adapt to all the changes that they see, right? And the changes that the sales team would see, or the changes that the customer support team would see. They would love this really adaptive and responsive engineering team. And the team and the engineers are usually these really team-oriented problem solvers, so they don't have any problem jumping on these things and helping out. But the heartburn comes at the end of the 90 days when everybody wants to know if you made any progress on those things that you said you were going to do, and you've spent your time doing something else. And so I think the way around that is really through data. It's really through transparency. It's really through some objectivity. And as the business asks for those changes, You need to allow them to acknowledge those changes, and you need to provide transparency and visibility that you're not working on those things anymore. And I think what I've always tried to do is shift the conversation a little bit to some of the objective data around what's the value of the things we're working on. So finding ways to objectively evaluate and value the things we're working on. And then I always say that the teams are working on the highest value things, and we all agree that we're working on the highest value things. Then the question should be, are we doing it in the most efficient way possible? Are we getting the most amount of work done possible? Are we demonstrating that we're getting better at that over time? Are we quantitatively, qualitatively demonstrating that the quality of the work product that's coming out of it is good? And so if we look at an engineering team and we can all agree to the fact that they are performing at a high level, that they continue to perform at a higher level, and that we're making the right decisions on the things that they're working on, I think everybody should be happy with that.
Yeah, I love the focus on, if we're working on the most valuable thing, then we're going the right direction. I'd love to hear an example, just kind of walk us through. So we've all been there where something changes, some salesperson had a conversation, we talked to a customer, and then that comes back to the team. And you talked about bringing data and objectivity into that process. Could you maybe walk us through something that's happened to you? I know you doubled your team last year, so I'm sure you've had a lot of that kind of change. I'd love to hear how it works.
And so, again, really smart people, we started to, and these are not non-agile concepts, but we started to sort of track and quantify where the teams were spending their time, right? Are we spending our time? How much of our time is being spent on things that we thought were on the strategic roadmap or the backlog? How much of our time did we think we were spending on those items that we were talking about, right? A customer asked for something. We had a sales opportunity that requires something. So we know how much time we spend on that. How much time do we spend on doing operational things where the engineering team is asked to help either deliver something or support something or do something with the data? And I think we found a lot of power in that. And what we're able to do with that then is tie that allocation back to what the goals of the company are. And so we are all here in business. We're all here to serve our customers. And so we have to get comfortable with the notion that we're going to spend some percentage of our time with these ad hoc requests that come in from a customer that we have to do. So that's real in our business today. And we just provide visibility that the engineering team spends 10% or 15% of their time doing that. And if we think, again, those are the highest value things to our organization, we shouldn't sweat it. If that leads to helping grow our business and serve those valuable customers, then we shouldn't sweat that.
So does that look like, the tickets or issues you're working on? Do they have a tag as far as one of those categories? How do you actually implement that tracking of where your time is going between strategic and ad hoc?
Yeah, we use Jira, like I'm sure many other companies do in our similar size and situation. So we identify things, the tasks that come through there or the stories that come through the teams, and we can put a tag on there. We don't try to overcook it. I think we have fewer than a handful of categories that we put on there. If it's something that's in our 90-day backlog, that's obviously a thing that we thought we were going to work on. If it's something that we accelerated farther down the roadmap, we call it a non-90-day roadmap, but it still is moving us in the direction that we want to take our product. If it's something that comes in as a customer request that maybe we haven't found a way to apply directly to our product strategy or direction, we call that a non-roadmap item, but we would value that as maintaining a relationship with a customer or opening up a revenue opportunity with a new prospect. The one that's kind of got my attention lately is I'm working a lot on getting, I said we went from 35 people to 75 people. I want to make sure those 75 people are in their lanes. And so anytime I see the engineering team doing operational things, being pulled into doing implementation or doing a support or working on a data pipeline, how the data comes in or goes out, that stuff's got my attention. And so we raise that up. And I said through transparency and visibility is how we manage our business. And we've kind of pivoted a little bit of our roadmap priority now that says our shorter term strategic roadmap is to work on things that will automate the operation and delivery of our platform so that we can get all teams in their lanes, and it's paying off. It's not something we want to do forever, but if we make that short-term investment now, we're going to be increasingly more efficient and productive going forward.
I like that. So then you got a pie chart you can share with the rest of the business. So this is where we spend our time. Is this the right mix?
And everybody can say, well, that looks good, or we can assert that it doesn't look good, and we change our priorities accordingly.
Yeah, I love problems that we can solve with transparency. That sounds like a great way to do it.
Data and transparency. We're sort of a data analytics company anyway, so we solve all of our problems by bringing visibility to data.
That sounds very on brand. So you doubled your team in the last year. What's the biggest scaling challenge that you worked through as you went through that rapid growth?
It's picked up in we have a company goal this year to transform from brilliant individuals to high performing teams. And so you scour a market. And so I've either learned that here or other places. When you scale fast, you scour the market and you try to suck up as many of these A players as possible and get them on your team. And it's so important that when they get here, you have a framework for how you bring them onto the team as fast as possible, how you get them in the teams, how you get them thinking about doing things in the way that the team wants to do things. Because for better or worse, oftentimes really smart people bring to their new jobs the things that made them successful in their previous job. And you love that. That's what you kind of hope they would do. But one day you wake up and you got 20 people who all have this different perspective on how to be productive. And so getting them all to kind of figure out how to come together and work as a team is a really big challenge and something we think about quite a bit.
What are some things that you've seen, you know, they're A players, they're meeting your definition of top performing individuals, but they're bringing in stuff that's disruptive to your organization. What are some of those things that they've brought in that, you know, cause that misalignment?
An example that comes to my mind right now is we've invested in a cool space here where we all come together. I'm trying to create a culture where everybody wants to come into this cool space. It's tailor-made for us. It's a place where we're supposed to come together and do this cool thing at Rebel. And I want people in the building and in our space working together. So we're not yet at a spot where we need to have co-located or distributed teams. We don't need to have work from home. And so sometimes you've got people who have been successful in that model before and think that they're more productive if they work from home. But I think an A player not only makes themselves productive, but an A player makes everybody productive, right? An A player, when you play next to an A player, you get better. And they make everybody better. And so if somebody doesn't buy into being in this space and they think they get more done by going someplace else and doing their work, that doesn't work for me.
I think that seems like a tension I see pretty often. It seems like there might be a trend towards that expectation. Have you seen that through your career, that expectation of work from home increasing over time?
Yeah, I think to be competitive now in terms of recruiting, I want to be flexible. And so we have things in place like flexible time off. We don't have our only policy is we want to make sure you're taking time off. We haven't capped time off. We have a flexible time off policy. We have we've got a lot of people with young families and busy lives. And so if there are things that you need to do and you need to be gone or you need to leave early or come in late, that flexibility is there. I have zero problem with that. And I think I can recruit with that. But so in the selection process, I just need to make sure that we all understand that by and large, we have a culture where we want to be in the same spot and work together. And if that's not what the individual we're talking to wants to do, no matter how talented they are, I just don't, it's not going to work.
How much longer do you think we'll be able to keep our teams together? So I know in 1,000 years, probably we'll have, I don't know, some sort of space helmets. So I know it'll happen then, but you know, probably not next year.
I wonder if the question should be, how much longer can we, or how much longer should we?
Yeah, I like that question too.
I try not to be old fashioned, right? I can't be old fashioned. I can't, because I had to lead a lot of really cool, smart people who are progressive thinkers, but I'm just not yet ready to surrender the value of human interaction. And I'm not yet ready to surrender the value of sitting down and being able to read body language and read a room and sit down in the break room and have lunch together or sit down and have coffee together. I just haven't given up. I just can't give up on the value of that yet. I know there are technologies like the ones we're using right now that make it easy to work together and collaborate. I know there are technologies that allow teams literally on half a world apart to feel like they're in the same room. And that's great. That's allowing us to tap talent that is worldwide, literally worldwide. And me with a company of 75 people right now, I think I can keep them all in one place. But if, you know, there might be, I don't know what the tipping point is. I don't know what the number would be where that's no longer realistic.
Yeah, I heard a but, and I'd love to hear what the but is. You know, the technology is good, and there's a but, because I think this is a topic. There's a lot of opinions floating around, and I think it's a kind of an inflection point where this is coming up and more.
It is. I've worked with people who are all you know, different ends of the spectrum, and I don't know where you land on this. I've worked with people who don't even think we need an office, right? Why do we need an office? We have the technology. We can all just sit at home in our pajamas and do what we do. And I just don't feel like that is the most effective way to communicate. That's, I guess, maybe I'll be put out to pasture at some point in time for those views, but.
I think you nailed the tension exactly, which is people need to connect. We need to be able to read body language. We're fooling ourselves if we think that Slack and text communication is a substitute for that high bandwidth communication. I think you also nailed it with we need a way for teammates to make us better. And I think a lot of that, the standard way is you sit next to somebody, you see what they're doing. The thing that I see some companies doing is taking that first principle and then figuring out a way to meet those needs for connection and high bandwidth communication with the tools. And I think it's like wearing ankle weights. It's absolutely harder. Like, you just don't get it for free. You can't just like show up on your first day and, you know, someone meets you at the water cooler. It's just, it's harder. And it's the thing that I kind of fall on, though, you said you're at 75, is eventually everybody is a distributed company. We all split on multiple floors. So it's kind of, what do we do when we have to split on two floors of the building? Right? What do you think the first thing that you'll have to change once that happens? I think you've been through companies that did that before. So I'd love to hear kind of what breaks whenever you split.
Well, I think there's interesting, right? These are all social experiments. Do we group teams that work together on different floors, right? Or do we group teams that work together on different floors to force a mix, to force people to get up and out of their chair? My inclination would be to, if we grew, right, you've nailed our plan exactly. When we grow in this space, we will be adding another floor. We've got the option to move up or down in our space here, and that'll be an exciting day when we do that. But then we'll have some separation, and it's just, that's the first step to separation. And the next step is, we're starting to find talent on the, we're in Minneapolis, and we'd start to find talent on the coast, right? We'd start to find talent in the East Coast, and we'll start to find talent on the West Coast. And how do we do that? And where do we start with engineering teams, or do we start with our revenue generating teams? Those are different questions. I think the fortunate thing is that the technology now is emerging to allow us to do that and to support that. But I just think it's just a different perspective on how you leverage that technology. Are you starting from the perspective that you want to be a distributed team, work from anywhere, and you're going to do that because these technologies are available? Or are you starting from the perspective that you value human interaction, you value co-location, you value what that does for the fabric of your culture? And as you have exceptions to that, do you leverage technology to help accommodate those exceptions? And I think I'm obviously in that camp where when I have to make those decisions and as my company grows or as we find talent elsewhere, I'm happy that there are technologies that are making it easier and easier. But I love the way you said it. There, it's we're were playing basketball with ankle weights on then. It's harder. It's just harder to communicate really that way. You got knuckleheads like me who you can't figure out which headset to put on when they're going into a podcast, right? You know, and I get into these Zoom meetings, and the first 10 minutes of my Zoom meeting are figuring out how to get everybody on that Zoom call and how to get everybody's face up on the screen. And that frustrates me that we spend time wrestling with technology so that we can communicate versus spending time on our business.
Yeah, there's definitely some frictions to be addressed. And I think people that are going into a distributed team without realizing that they're going to have a plan to address those frictions, I think they're decreasing, and I'm happy about that. I'm going to plug a product that I've my favorite. The whole for me has always been whiteboarding. Like whiteboarding remote has always just been way worse. Like a Google Doc is no substitute for a whiteboard. And there's a tool called Miro, M-I-R-O. So if you ever have remote whiteboarding session, that's like it's a game changer for us. My team is mostly, we're in the same city, but we're all distributed. So it's Miro is awesome.
Is that right through your laptop or your desktop? You can whiteboard right there.
Yeah, sticky notes, diagrams, drop in videos, do video chat, timers, like dot voting, all of the nice like design thinking stuff. It's pretty great. If I was a startup investor, I would be investing in that company because it's so great.
That's a really good topic. I think it's one that's going to continue to change and evolve in our industry for sure.
Absolutely. So Kyle, you've got a magic wand and you can spread one idea out into the zeitgeist about hiring that's going to improve hiring for our entire industry. You can kill an idea, you can create an idea. What's the idea that you would impact to make hiring better across software engineering?
I think just hiring in general is, I would like to get rid of happy ears, right? And so this isn't a magic wand. This is just hard work. We have to be more thoughtful about it, right? And I'm afraid too many hiring decisions get made by the first impression when you get in that room and you sit down in the chair across from somebody. And we really have to be thoughtful about how we tease out the cultural fit, how we tease out their proficiency to do something, how we tease out their desire to work within the environment that we have. And so, yeah, I wish there was a magic wand that could solve these things, but I think this is one where it's just going to require some heavy lifting and commitment to a process like that.
I understand you're also a fan of the book, Who, the A Method of Hiring, which I also really like that book. And it's got a lot of great insight. And I understand you can incorporate scorecards into your hiring process. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you use scorecards?
Yeah. So we use a hiring and recruiting tool, and we found that it was flexible enough that we could create a template for each interviewers to follow during the process. And within that template, we have built in kind of a flexible scorecard that starts with the job description or the things that we want from a particular candidate. It starts with, and it also includes specific questions around the culture that we have at Rebel or that we try to create at Rebel. And so we were really thoughtful about when we hire somebody, or when we go through an interview process, we get the hiring team or the interview team in a room and we go through the scorecard and we divvy up sort of who wants to cover what part and gather certain pieces of information that are important to us. And we got some people who are really good at gleaning or teasing out technical proficiency. We got some people who are really good at teasing out cultural fit. We got some people who are good at teasing out desire and environmental fit. So we're just intentional about it. We've got that in our tool. And sometimes for whatever reason, we get away from it and it comes up a situation where we don't use the things that we know we should use. And those are the times when we haven't hit the mark.
It's always tempting to bend the rules for one person. Happy ears, like you said, or sometimes the opposite. That's a hard lesson that I've had to learn myself. Who is the best engineer that you've worked with that was maybe bad on paper? Maybe their resume wasn't quite right.
I have a a colleague who I've worked with for a long time, who on paper, they're you know, from an education background, from an experience background, does not scream at you that this is a person who should work in the technology industry and is going to set it on fire. But every time I get a chance to work with this individual, as we each change positions, I jump at it, because the intangibles of this person are the can do, and they're innately intelligent, and they are innately curious, and it's just they want to solve a problem. So given a problem in a technology space, they are able to quickly do the research, acquire the knowledge, apply it in a very efficient way, and come up with solutions. And they're just tickled and delighted that they could do it. And that person, again, their CV or resume or background or education wouldn't scream to you that they have that talent. So it's really hard. When I talked about the scorecard and being intentional, how do you identify? I think it's really interesting how to identify intangibles in the hiring process. And this person has intangibles. They're just innate intelligence, curiosity, problem solvers, humility, right? Team first, goal first. They don't think about themselves. It's just amazing.
That sounds like a great teammate. And I don't know where someone puts that on a resume. If they put that on a resume, I wouldn't believe them, right?
I've even had a hard time hiring this person in the past, because I say, I introduce them to the organization and say, this is a guy who if we ever get a chance to work with, I want to work with him. And then he comes in and interviews and they say, well, I don't know what he's going to do. And I say, whatever you want him to do, that's what he's going to do. He's going to be really good at it.
Yeah. Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. In our interview, Kyle emphasized the importance of finding objective ways to evaluate candidates. When used effectively, these tools can reduce disparities in hiring and in compensation. That's the reason why we started Woven. Woven is a developer screening platform that reduces bias and noise in software hiring. We empower hiring managers with a detailed assessment of every candidate based on an hour-long work simulation. Our clients make decisions about who they spend time with based on ability to do the job, not just on a resume. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your software team, check us out at woventeams.com. So it's time for our rapid fire round. So I'm going to ask a question and you'll give us your quick reaction. Let's do it. What's the most impressive thing a candidate has done in an interview that helped you realize they were a great fit?
Well, they come in prepared. Right, they come in prepared. They know our business. They know the role. They know about me, and they're just on target.
What's a mistake you've seen an engineering candidate make in an interview that they didn't realize they were making?
I think confidence is a slippery slope, and so you want to portray a competency and a proficiency, but I don't think that you want to portray overconfidence or hubris in an interview.
Hard skills versus soft skills, catalytic skills. Which is more important for an engineering candidate?
God, it's hard to say that. Soft skills. I mean, if I have somebody who is a brilliant engineer and it just destroys the chemistry of the team, I'd rather not have part of the business.
What does a 6-star culture fit? So even better than a 5-star culture fit look like for your team at Revel?
A 6-star culture fit to me is, I like working with smart people. So it's a smart person. It's a humble person. This is a team first person. They have to be driven, want it in our business. And I like somebody who displays a high degree of personal ownership. Those are some traits of people I think make 6-star people.
My guest today has been Kyle Gunderson. Kyle, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams.
It's been my honor. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Kyle for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, data is your friend when talking product roadmaps. We all know that hitting date-based product roadmaps targets can be tough. It's double hard when ad hoc requests eat time. all of Kyle's Jira tickets are tagged based on the relation to the current product roadmap goals. That allows him to say what percentage of his team's time was spent on non-roadmap goals when talking to other executives. His categories are strategic roadmap, customer requests, new business requests, and ad hoc operations. Number two, remote work is not a free lunch. Kyle points out the many ways in which remote work is harder than co-located work. Culture and camaraderie are more difficult to spread. Management is harder. As a leader of a remote team, I absolutely agree. Running remote requires extra effort in order to reap those extra rewards. Number three, the best hiring process is built to uncover evidence. One of the things that makes hiring so hard is that few of us were taught how to hire. We know how to conduct an interview, maybe, and read a resume, but many of us operate more on gut than on science. That's a problem, which is why Kyle's team uses a scorecard for every interview. He divvies up line items on the scorecard to different members of his team. Then each team member searches for evidence that a given hire has the required technical aptitude, culture fit, and desire to make them successful in the role. This helps his team make decisions based more on facts than on opinions. Thanks again to Kyle for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next week.